Welcome to the Resource People Podcast, presented to you by Australian Resources and Energy Group, AMA. The Resource People Podcast brings to life the stories behind the people, workforces and companies of our great industry.
Hi, it's Tara from AMA. Thanks so much for joining us on another episode of Resource People Podcast. Really excited to discuss with Jim Caldwell, the CEO at Atlas Professionals, how the business and Jim's leadership has really been managing uncertainty in the face of a lot of acquisitions and change of structure in their organisation. We'll also hear how Atlas has responded to the changes faced by the oil and gas sector and by oil and gas contractors during COVID-19. Hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Resource People Podcast, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fantastic. Can you get us started, please, by telling us about Atlas Professionals?
Sure. Atlas Professionals has been in its present form around for about 3.5 years. It's a joint venture between Atlas, who are based in the Netherlands, and Programmed, who obviously are a labour provider in Australia. So it's a 50-50 joint venture. We predominantly operate offshore. And our work split really into thirds. A third would be marine. A third would be in this rig drilling space and subsea space. We have catering work, and our newest area is in the renewable sector.
Oh, that's exciting. And how many people do you employ in Australia?
So currently we're running at about 700. At our peak, we would have been about 3,500. But obviously COVID has had a bit of impact on that recently.
Yeah, I want to get onto that in a moment. And thanks for that prompt for COVID. But what about your background? What was your journey that led you to Atlas Professionals as their CEO?
It's a varied one. When I left school, I joined the military and served 9 years in the Royal Air Force in the UK and some other countries. I moved into a selling job, which eventually led me to the resources sector. Mm-hmm. I picked up a job with a company called Global Energy, who are multidisciplined offshore oil and gas, and they invited me to move out to Australia. From then, we went to OMS, Offshore Marine Services, who were then bought by Skilled Offshore. Skilled was then bought by Programmed, and then finally the joint venture was set up about 3.5 years ago between Programmed and Atlas, and I took the lead then.
It's certainly been a journey, and starting at the military and landing here in Australia, how's that shaped your style of leadership? And question from that is, how's that evolved over the time of all those different machinations of the organisation you're with now?
It's really interesting. The military teaches you a lot about teamwork, relying on people, and you're only as good as your weakest link. It also teaches you a little bit about discipline, which comes in very handy in the role that we currently have, where compliance is so important. I've been very lucky to have some real inspirational leaders over my career who've helped to mold the way that I work. And one of those big things is in my management style is try to treat everybody with respect. Everybody has an opinion and it's valid, but ultimately somebody has to make a decision. To be honest, when I was younger, making decisions probably wasn't something I was very comfortable with. But as I've grown older, it's something I'm much more happy with now. But I do enjoy, in our organization, we have core value, which is courage. And that courage is to have difficult conversations. And I do enjoy a difficult conversation and coming to an outcome at the end of all of that.
And that certainly probably shaped a bit of the year. And before I start asking you about the response and the activities during COVID, you touched on Atlas Professionals' journey in terms of the number of acquisitions and mergers and joint ventures, etc., which I'm sure brings about lots of really interesting opportunities, but also workforce challenges. What has been your key in that quite recent journey in the last kind of 5-10 years to managing that kind of organizational change?
I think what it's taught me over the piece is that the culture is very important, and acquisition is not always the answer, because you can bring in different cultures and sometimes they don't mix.
Okay.
And you have to find your own way, your own style. And as an organization, it reflects who we are. we had some challenges, skilled and programmed, where direct competitors in the offshore space. And that is quite a difficult marriage to start off with, but we found our way through. And I think also being able to have the Atlas brand helped change that. So we brought then our own core values from the best of both worlds and melded them into what we are now as Atlas.
That merging of competitors, and for anyone that knows the oil and gas contracting space, and it's pretty competitive. So what kind of things were you challenged with that bringing together of those two previous competing organizations?
Well, I mean, in that offshore space, 3 to 5 years ago, or maybe, sorry, it's maybe a bit longer than that, it was 80% of the market was controlled by skilled offshore and program marine in the vessel space, particularly. We had a philosophy, if you're coming back to sort of the IR philosophy, you had skilled who weren't really union centric, and you had program that were much more engaged with the unions. So there was that piece. You had skilled that were perhaps slightly more lean than programmed were in overhead. And that was challenging as well. And then obviously you had the downturn in the oil and gas market at that time when you're trying to bring together two cultures. But the positive that came out of that was we ended up with a really, really strong team and a very strong culture that came out the back of it.
Wow. And I guess talking about downturns, let's get straight to the meat of what's happening at the moment. And we know that the oil and gas sector has been hit incredibly hard by COVID-19. Can you share with us how it's impacted Atlas?
It's meant that we've had to adapt incredibly quickly to changing circumstances. We saw a large amount of projects. Our year up until the first quarter of this year was going very well. We were tracking along at budget pace, and then obviously COVID happened and a large swathe of our projects just disappeared, which meant rapid change. We had to adapt quickly. Right-sizing the business goes in there as well, and then you have that piece around retaining personnel, retaining capability, versus overhead when you're having diminished turnover. The borders, obviously, with the way that they changed, one day you could bring people in, the next day you couldn't. And then a resource business where we have people over east coming west and west coming east, that was challenging time for us. I think we've got a handle on that now, and certainly the stability with the hard border closure in WA has helped. It's helped form some of our policies around the way that we look at resourcing projects. And it also put us at the forefront of some interesting collaboration with our customers. So in our marine sector, we have a permanent workforce, as do most of our clients. But we had clients with permanent workforce stranded in different parts of Australia that couldn't come across the borders. So we looked at a way of pulling that resource together. So sharing employees to man different vessels, which was a bit novel.
So lots of solutions out of really challenging circumstances. And I'd imagine at your perspective, a lot of probably really difficult decisions throughout 2020. So, Jim, industrial relations news and stories have really dominated the media, particularly the business sector media, in addition to the border closures and the government response and stimulus, etc. How has the COVID-19 pandemic and the oil and gas downturn really impacted Atlas from an industrial relations perspective?
Atlas is always engaged with the unions. Our strategy is to inform the unions as to what's going on. I think COVID has forced companies and us in particular to engage more with the unions, but not just the unions, with our workforce, ensuring they're very aware of what's going on with information that we have in hand. I mean, if you look at the JobKeeper allowance and how that works in our industry, utilising that has been helpful for some of those projects that have gone away. And, you know, thank goodness the government put that in place. It certainly helped our business to retain capability. If we look at the staff in our offices, we've all been impacted, and we're enforcing at the moment a four-day week because of loss of revenue. So the choice was redundancies versus retaining capabilities but cutting back on hours. And as a business, we discussed it and we decided that we'd prefer to retain that capability rather than try to enforce those redundancies at a time when there's a lack of jobs in the marketplace. It forces us to think about our people. And as a people business, we should be doing that all the time.
I guess that leads to ask the question about, you touched on that your strategy is to engage with the unions, but really a heavy emphasis on engaging and collaborating with your workforce. So can you tell us a bit about the industrial relations strategy at Atlas, and what were the main things that you were considering when you were looking into this uncertain time and moving through it?
So I don't think we varied from what we were doing prior to that. It's almost like we doubled down on it.
Yeah, right.
You know, so we engage directly with the unions, and we have for the last 3 years, you know, and we play the no surprise game. Good news, bad news, it's just news, so no surprises. We engage with our clients as well to keep them in the loop. So we will tell our clients, look, this is what we're going to be doing. And so that they feel that we have complete control over what we're doing. I think that's been reciprocated in the main from the unions as well when we speak to them. That no surprises is something that works for them, because they don't like a phone call from their members saying what the hell is going on. Mm. And I don't think that's everybody's approach, but that's the approach we've taken. And so far, it seems to be working.
That really leads me to think about how your people that work in employee and industrial relations, and how they really would have to work with your operations team, given that we had challenges in place around the border, additional restrictions in terms of the amount of people that were allowed in operations and on site. How did the two groups, from your perspective, work together to really, as you say, double down on your existing strategy?
It's communication, 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 right? Mm. So regular communication. We have weekly operations meetings where the IR team and our crewing team get together to talk about what's going on. We do weekly workforce planning, where we go down to the granular level on that just to see what's happening. We make sure everybody's on the same page. We have the same message, and the messaging is very firm and controlled. Everybody in the organization knows how important that stuff is for the business. And I take a keen interest in that. So, for instance, the weekly workforce planning, I'll attend that to ensure that we know exactly where we are. Probably the main things there to make sure that that strategy works, communication. And no surprises, right?
Yeah, I like those two themes that are coming through here in this conversation. And then maybe too early to call, Jim, but what have you seen as the outcome of implementing this highly engaged, largely with your workforce, but also with a social partner with the unions? What has been the outcome from your perspective?
We've engaged in a few town halls with union engagement. We tried to get a win-win situation. Can't really give specifics around some of the things that we've put in place, but we have had a few MOUs that sit to the side of our current EAs to clarify any sort of grey areas that there might be. We make sure that we have in writing as well specific details of each of our parties' positions, so that we know there's clarity around that. We think it's very important that we have an end date, so it's clearly defined, that clauses that parties understand how we do stuff. So, for instance, if an MOU isn't delivering, then how would we then extricate ourselves from that if it wasn't delivering the outcomes that was mutually beneficial?
So with this no surprises, being very transparent and clear, you've just touched on, you know, some of the strategies you deployed in terms of putting things in writing and having end dates and those sorts of things. At your level, what are you quantifying as in the savings that this approach has led your business to have? You know, not only financially, but that is hugely important, but also from a workplace culture and capability perspective.
Culturally, I've been quite interesting. We've surveyed staff, not offshore personnel, as to the approach that we've taken with the guys here. And in the main, I would say 80% of them are happy with the approach that we've taken, whether that be from the support working from home to coming back into the office to the staged approach of that and making sure our employees are gainfully employed. It's also about retaining the offshore staff on JobKeeper, where they're traditionally, I think, perhaps labour hire companies would cut them loose. We see an end date here, and we think it's important that we retain them. We think there's a loyalty piece for us there. Financially as well, financially, with the way that we work, we believe we save maybe potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars in that space. And that's just about minimizing the losses perhaps we would have if we didn't have those in place. And look, and mental health obviously has a cost associated with it. And I think some of that engagement piece that we've done in there, our EAP provider, the way that we've dealt with the isolation, ensuring the guys are in isolation are contacted by the crewing officers, we think that's absolutely crucial. And again, I think that helps us reputationally. And we want our reputation to stay intact during this and not be seen as taking advantage of a crisis, but actually working with our clients, working with our staff and our employees for as best an outcome in a bad situation as possible.
Yeah, that's a really great approach. And you just mentioned in one of your answers that you see that this will end. And I guess that's hard for a lot of people to quantify, particularly when people like Victorians or other people around the world or indeed even offshore have been really challenged by some of the border and travel restrictions. So from where you're sitting today, this is a little bit of crystal ball gazing, Jim. How is the future shaping up for Atlas and its workforce? And how do you prepare for an uncertain future?
Tara, you sound like my board.
Oh, gosh.
Look, it's interesting, right? Because with a board made up in the Netherlands, where Europe is absolutely being hammered right at this moment with COVID, versus Australia, where we've been very lucky, it's quite difficult to predict. And if you speak to some people, they say if you can predict the next 3 months, you're doing very, very well, right? But the one thing about our industry is that the gas and the oil is always going to be there. Currently, there is going to be a demand, at least for the next 10 years, you know, and, or longer. You think about the future moving towards renewables. We're a long way from having offshore wind and, you know, hydrogen. So there is a future there. So we're planning for the long haul. We understand that there will be projects. You know, next year, currently, we're looking at a year that it looks okay. We think that towards the second half of the year, things are going to get better, or at least we'll be living and understanding how to deal with the crisis much better. I think that for us as a business, our transition into renewables is going to be the future for us, but understanding that offshore, there's vessels that are required for that, and there will always be a need at the moment for oil and gas. Mm.
Very pragmatic approach, Jim. And one thing, you know, you've touched on renewables and a lot of AMA members have been, you know, moving in that space, whether they're an asset owner or a contractor, really as a sustainable future in terms of their operations, but also getting into it as an investment and into future industry. But I want to take you back to Australia's marine and oil and gas industries. You touched on mental health before and the importance of that. As an industry, we've done a lot of work to support our workforces in really challenging time. But what do you see the changing demands and the changing landscape for Australia's marine and oil and gas industry?
One of the things that I think is quite interesting, having come from Europe into what was a booming, absolutely booming oil and gas economy 5 or 6 years ago, where we couldn't find enough people to go offshore, and we had lots of clients, we're seeing that downsize has happened, and we're actually seeing quite an aging workforce. I think a challenge will be finding people who want to come into an industry where you're working shift patterns that are antisocial when they could be working onshore. And we've lost some of, if you go back in history, you look at the late 80s when there was a downturn, we lost a whole load of experience. And that's a worry safety-wise. If we have an age group of plus 50s who have a whole wealth of experience deciding that enough is enough and taking something that's a little bit easier, possibly onshore, or not as family demanding. You know, coming back to that sort of the future of the oil and gas, I worry about safety a lot, right? I would really, really do. And I worry about the skills that are leaving the industry. And how do you attract talent, Tara, to an industry that, you know, investment houses are saying, right, we're getting out of coal, we're going to get out of oil, gas is probably the next thing that we'll get out of. And so it becomes almost, in the long term, a sunset industry. And if you want your graduates to come in, are they going to go to to something like that, or are they going to go to something that's a bit more green, environmentally friendly? It's a difficult one, right?
It's such a challenge for Australia, given that so much of our economy, and we've seen through COVID, certainly for the minerals that have had a better time in terms of their commodity prices than oil and gas, have really delivered to Australia the sustained contributions to the government that have enabled the government to make really important decisions that you said Australia's lucky, but a lot of that's got to do with the management and the economy. And so Australia has to transition and do that in an orderly way. But have you got a suggestion? Have you been thinking about how you can attract people to your organisation when we're in the middle of confronting how this potential transition looks?
Something I think about a lot, actually. And again, having come from Europe, and particularly the area that I'm from the north of Scotland, and it used to be a hub for rigs. So we built rigs, Ardersier, mm-hmm. Neg, Kishorn. These were all fabrication facilities that got mothballed. But now I look at something like Neg, which is now an energy park, and offshore wind is a massive part of that. And they're turning out turbines left, right and centre. And that has become a really, really, I think that's a great model of the way that Australia could move if we're looking at offshore wind as the future. It's high skilled jobs with high pay, rightly so. And that area was selected because of the oil and gas personnel that were there that had great skills that were transferable and moved across, right? But it also took vision from local government and government to invest in that area and to support it. And what I like at the moment, what I love about Australia is that Australia is a wonderful country, right? And the facilities that we have here, and coming back to the economic stability and the way that that's been invested in the country, it's wonderful. We're so lucky to be living in this country, frankly. And I and our organisation, where we're going is we're going to invest in that new energy, and we're going to transition people out from oil and gas into that area. That's the future for our business over the next 20 or 30 years.
Thank you for giving us some insight into the types of thing you think about and being able to articulate a vision. You know, lots of things need to line up for that to happen. But if it gives people hope and some context of how that can happen in terms of a transition. And, you know, Jim, we also always love it when we have people that grew up in other countries telling us how fantastic Australia is. So thanks for that. But I've got to ask you, Atlas is really well known for its Indigenous training and marine program. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, look, we're incredibly proud of that area of the business. It's so important to us. Over a number of years, we have engaged very, very heavily in there in traineeships. It probably starts before my time, but I can think of when we, as part of OMSA, which is part of Skilled, we were heavily involved in the transportation of barges to and from Henderson up to Barrow Island and back. And we had a very large Indigenous training program there where we were able to put a large number of people through their tickets to become integrated ratings.
Fantastic.
I mean, I kind of think that's where it all really started. We engage really, really heavily with local Clontarf Foundation here. We enjoy that very, very much. And more recently, we have had our first Indigenous cadets qualify as officers offshore, which is absolutely fantastic. And that's been a couple of years worth of work.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know what? It's so exciting. And to see the guys, a couple of them were in the office the other day just having passed their orals. Everybody felt the energy when they came into the office, which was good. And, you know, and it's not just about them. It's about the families and the support that goes with that. And we tailor our programs around our clients as well. So what are our clients requiring?
So Atlas, from what I understand, has a reputation of being really reliable and dependable. Indigenous employment hasn't been something that you come in and out of. Has there been a long-term strategy around Indigenous employment? Has it been driven by Atlas, or is it something that's done really perhaps in partnership with your clients as well?
It's a bit of both, Tara. To be fair, I don't believe in training for training's sake. I think you have to have outcomes at the end of it. Otherwise, it's pretty pointless, to be honest with you. And you want to retain those skills. So if you've invested the time, effort, you want to see something at the back of it. So retaining the personnel after they're trained is almost in many ways more important than actually just getting them through the training. It does require support from our clients buy into that. But I think more and more over the years, clients understand how important that is for their businesses and also for the wider community.
Resources and Energy does quite well in that space because of the areas in which we operate. But more broadly, you know, why do you think Indigenous workforce participation is such a challenge for employers?
It requires a bit of effort, Tara, to be fair. Time and effort. It's also about managing expectations, making sure everybody's aware of what's required. And it's the right thing to do.
That leads me onto a question which is very challenging in your industry and sector, which is female workforce participation.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's really tough for employers in your industry?
I think about in our organisation, Tara, we encourage maternity leave. We support it. Most of the senior leaders in my business are females, and it's not because they're females, it's because they're bloody good at what they do. And I think that I feel that females just want a level playing field, and they want to be attracted to interesting careers and not to be judged on their sex, but to be judged on their ability. And at Atlas, we support that. I think that's a very important thing. But also, you can't have an industry where you're 95% is all male. So you have to make positive changes to that as well. And if we look at some of the training programs that we're putting together over the next couple of years, there will be a focus, obviously, in Indigenous engagement, but also female participation as well, to try and increase those numbers in the highly skilled jobs as well. It's not just the sort of lower paying end. It's actually the degree educated with a career pathway going forward to pushing out the men because of ability.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head there, because across all sectors, that's, you know, where we see the really next frontier for creating more inclusive and diverse workforces. It's in the areas that are trades, are operators, are in the highly technical areas, opposed to the more head office functions or administrative functions. So very proud of that focus that you have, and we'll support you in doing that. And really just want to thank you for sharing your insight about what's happening at Atlas Professionals and the journey that you've been on in 2020 and your vision for what comes next. Thanks, Jim, so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tara. I enjoyed that. That was good. Thanks.
Pleased to be able to share with you the really interesting journey of Atlas Professionals and to hear from Jim Caldwell around a range of topics today. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of Resource People Podcast. I'm Tara Diamond.
Thank you for listening to the Resource People Podcast. We look forward to you joining us next time as we highlight the many great stories of the resources and energy industry. If you have any questions about the podcast, please email media@ama.org.au. Produced by Brad Thompson.